Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the December 24th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is a Christmas scene. It's a snowy rooftop. Santa is standing next to the chimney. Looks like he's getting ready to climb down. He's got his bag of presents over his shoulder. It's a full moon in the background. Santa and two of the reindeer have masks on. And the headline is, "Another COVID Christmas. Will Omicron again postpone a return to some semblance of normalcy?" And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. CDC warns of incoming Omicron wave. What happened? As U.S. COVID deaths pass the 800,000 mark, federal health officials warned this week that the nation could soon be deluged by a wave of new cases driven by the highly infectious Omicron variant. This is going to take off. The numbers of people who get sick will be substantial, said Marcus Plesha of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. He was among several experts who, in a CDC briefing, warned of the variant's breakneck rate of spread and its potential to overwhelm hospitals already filled with COVID patients sickened by the Delta variant. Omicron now accounts for nearly 3% of U.S. cases, a sevenfold jump within a week. Britain's health secretary said Omicron was spreading at a phenomenal rate, with cases doubling every few days. "Omicron is moving faster even than the most pessimistic among us thought it was going to move," said Jacob Lemieux, an infectious disease physician at Harvard Medical School. Much remained uncertain about the variant's virulence and ability to evade vaccine protection, and emerging evidence offered reasons for both hope and for worry. A South African study showed that two doses of Pfizer's vaccine were only 33% effective against Omicron infection, a steep decline from previous variants. Figures from both Denmark and the U.S. showed that some three-quarters of patients infected with Omicron had been fully vaccinated. But the South African study showed two Pfizer doses were 70% effective against severe disease and indicated that Omicron is producing milder cases, with a 29% lower risk of hospitalization. And a British study showed that a third Pfizer dose significantly boosted protection against Omicron, raising effectiveness against severe illness to 75%. California and New York reimposed indoor mask mandates, and companies including Ford, Uber, and Google delayed plans to return workers to the office. Some infectious disease experts said the Omicron threat should make people reconsider planned holiday gatherings. "It's time to step back and reevaluate," said Harvard Medical School professor Amy Bartzak. What the editorial said: "Omicron's arrival should be a call to action," said the Washington Post. "Yes, we're all sick to death of sacrifice, misery, and disruption, but we have the tools to fight Omicron if they are unequivocally used. Multiple studies show that good face masks substantially reduce transmission in crowded indoor spaces. Vaccines and booster uptake must be aggressively promoted, and Republicans should end their misguided efforts to block President Biden's vaccine mandates." The Biden administration, meanwhile, needs to follow Britain's example and make home tests free and plentiful. "Amid the fear and uncertainty are two rays of light," said the Buffalo News. "One is preliminary evidence that Omicron may bring milder illness and fewer and shorter hospital stays. The other is that boosters appear to provide significant protection against Omicron. That only underlines the importance of getting vaccinated and boosted, our surest escape from more infections, more hospitalization, and more deaths. What the columnist said. For vaccinated people, Omicron is deflating news, said Rachel Gutman in TheAtlantic.com. The 60% of Americans who've received their jabs have gotten used to feeling bulletproof, but Omicron may cause a wave of breakthrough infections. Restaurants, indoor arenas, offices, and other settings that have come to feel safe may become fertile ground for transmission. And that's nothing compared with what the variant may bring to places with low vaccination rates and strong anti-shutdown politics, which could face mass death and even greater grief. Millions of Americans are stuck in a COVID booster gap, said Caitlin Owens in Axios.com. Among the 150 million Americans who've been vaccinated but not boosted are 58 million who aren't yet eligible for boosters because their last dose was less than 6 months ago. Now that boosters appear to be crucial in fighting Omicron, the U.S. should consider setting a shorter time frame for eligibility, as Britain and Denmark have just done. Even if it proves true that Omicron cases are relatively mild, and that's a big if, the variant may overwhelm hospitals, said Joanne Keenan in Politico.com. More than 1,200 Americans are already dying daily amid a Delta surge that holiday gatherings will likely worsen. If Omicron sparks an exponential outbreak, even a small percentage of serious illnesses will put a whole lot of strain on already reeling healthcare systems. As we face a potential tsunami of new cases, a terrible feeling of deja vu is setting in, said David Wallace Wells in NYMag.com. Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, burned out Americans are unlikely to put up with severe restrictions and school closures, no matter how bad things get. As Omicron looms, an exhausted nation seems to have reached a state of resignation. We'll do a shorter second main story. Devastating tornadoes tear through Midwest and South. What happened? Rescue workers across the Midwest and South were digging through collapsed buildings and searching for survivors and bodies this week after a string of tornadoes ripped through nine states and left behind a trail of devastation. At least 90 people were killed by the storms, 80 of them in Kentucky, and more than 100 people were missing. Meteorologists said the violence of the tornadoes was almost unprecedented for this time of year, with radar showing that debris was thrown more than 30,000 feet in the air. At least 39 tornadoes were recorded. One monster twister with 200-mile-per-hour winds ripped apart a nursing home in Manette, Arkansas, killing a 94-year-old resident, before carving a path that was 230 miles long and up to three-quarters of a mile wide across Missouri, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Possibly the longest touchdown in history. In Kentucky, more than 1,000 properties were destroyed. Seven children were killed on a single street in the city of Bowling Green. A 128-mile-per-hour twister obliterated a Mayfield, Kentucky candle factory, killing eight people. Workers said supervisors had threatened them with dismissal if they left. Six workers at an Amazon warehouse in Edwardsville, Illinois, died when a 150-mile-per-hour tornado smashed into the building. The tornadoes may have been the result of a rare confluence of weather events. Almost spring-like temperatures, 20 to 30 degrees above normal for December, elevated humidity, and high wind shear. President Biden said the role of climate change in the storms wasn't clear, but we all know everything is more intense when the climate is warming. Everything. What the columnist said. Many of us Kentuckians think we're the chosen people when it comes to extreme weather, said Don Ray Smith in the Louisville Courier-Journal. Our state is normally spared the hurricanes, deep freezes, and wildfires that bedevil other parts of the U.S., but this twister outbreak proves Kentucky is not immune from climate change, which research suggests is causing Tornado Alley to move steadily eastward. We must brace ourselves for more random rages in the natural world. Democrats argue that such tragedies are now the new normal, said David Harsanyi in NationalReview.com, and that we must decarbonize the economy to defeat climate change. But the truth is that humans are safer than ever from extreme climate. Nearly 500,000 people worldwide die every year from climate-related disasters in the 1920s. By the 2000s, that number was down to 14,000. That's because we've developed better infrastructure and warning systems, and the death toll will continue to fall as we innovate. Adaptation is a lot more affordable than overturning modernity. This is more than a climate story, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. The tornadoes literally tore off the roof and exposed the reality of low-wage work in America. The candle factory's night shifters were told they might be fired if they fled, while a delivery driver in Edwardsville texted his girlfriend that Amazon won't let us leave before he was killed. These people were treated as disposable assets. After mourning the dead, we need to ask some tough questions about the nature of work in 21st century America. The controversy of the week is abortion. Courts conservatives show their hand. It may have sounded like a rare legal victory for pro-choicers, but don't be bamboozled, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. When the Supreme Court ruled 8-1 last week that Texas abortion providers can sue state licensing bodies over Texas' extreme new anti-abortion law, it seemed like a respite from weeks of ominous anti-choice signals from the court's new block of five far-right justices. But by letting the Texas law, which authorizes private citizens to sue abortion clinics for $10,000 for each abortion, stay in effect pending further litigation, the ruling in Whole Woman's Health versus Jackson shows just how radical this new conservative majority is. The ruling erases all doubt, said Molly Jongfast in Vogue.com. Roe v. Wade will fall this summer when the court rules on a challenge to a Mississippi abortion law. Ultra-conservative justices Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, Neil Gorsuch, Samuel Alito, and Clarence Thomas also made it clear in this ruling they are so partisan and so ideologically conservative that they will let states flout established precedent if they agree with the end goal. Even Chief Justice John Roberts was horrified. His colleagues, he wrote, have made a solemn mockery of the Constitution and given a green light to any state that wants to nullify this court's rulings and destroy the rights of its citizens. That's hysterical nonsense, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com. All the court did was uphold the traditional rule that federal courts don't evaluate a law's constitutionality until an actual plaintiff can show an actual injury. Yes, Texas lawmakers crafted their law to exploit this restraint, calculating that even the threat of expensive lawsuits would make abortion clinics preemptively close their doors. But the remedy liberals wanted, throwing out the Texas law before state courts have had a chance to rule on challenges, would bulldoze long-standing doctrines limiting power of federal courts. Let's see how the court's conservatives enjoy a taste of their own medicine, said Jahan Jones in MSNBC.com. Immediately following the decision, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced he'll introduce a bill letting citizens sue gun makers who sell assault weapons and so-called ghost guns. If Texas can use a bounty mechanism to ignore a woman's constitutional right to an abortion, then surely California can do the same to bypass the Second Amendment. It's a good stunt, said Ellie Mistel in TheNation.com, but it's doomed to fail. The court's conservatives are ideologues who do not feel bound by logic or consistency. Now that there are four of them to the right of Roberts, they will quickly kill California's bill despite letting Texas stand, because gun rights matter to them. Women's reproductive rights do not. As a result, women in Texas are effectively banned from securing a legal abortion in the state, said Maura Donegan in TheGuardian.com. The court was so eager to ban abortion right now that the justices couldn't even wait 6 months for their broader ruling on the Mississippi case. That's when they get to throw out a half century of precedent and overturn Roe itself, enabling more than 20 states to criminalize abortion again. Ever since former President Trump installed Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett to forge a 6-3 conservative majority, court watchers have wondered, if the court had to choose between maintaining its own power and legitimacy and overturning Roe, which would it choose? After last week's Texas ruling, we have our answer. Here's our good week, bad week piece. Seems it was a good week for nodding off, with a new study suggesting that as little as 15 seconds spent in hypnagogia, the first stage of falling asleep, can triple a person's capacity for creative problem solving afterward. It was a good week for coveting after Pope Francis told reporters that sins of the flesh, such as extramarital sex, are not the most serious. Far worse, Francis said, are the sins of pride and hatred. And it was a good week for remote workers after a federal court in Germany ruled that a man who injured himself at home while walking from his bed to his desk was technically commuting and is thus entitled to workers' compensation. But it was a bad week for feeling guilty after Sharon Watley, 50, of Eros, Louisiana, tried to turn herself in at the Monroe Police Department, but could not cite any crime she committed. Police found no outstanding warrants, but when Watley repeatedly refused to leave, she successfully got herself arrested for trespassing. It was a bad week for recycling after so many tickets went unsold for a Donald Trump appearance with former Fox News host Bill O'Reilly in Sunrise, Florida, that large sections of the arena were empty. One MAGA fan who paid $200 complained that Trump was an hour late and said nothing new. This was a ripoff, she tweeted. And finally, it was a bad week for the real killers, with the news that O.J. Simpson, 74, acquitted of murdering ex-wife Nicole and her friend Ron Goldman in 1994, has been discharged from parole on a 2008 armed robbery conviction in Nevada. Simpson's lawyer said his client is a completely free man now. Briefing this week is the failure to vaccinate Africa. The UN's COVAX program has delivered few doses to Africa, where the Omicron variant was first detected. Why? How is global vaccination going? By some metrics, remarkably well. In a little less than a year, more than 8.3 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines have been distributed globally, and 55% of the world's population has received at least one vaccine dose. But this monumental effort has left the undeveloped world behind, particularly in Africa. Only 6.6% of people in low-income countries have received at least one dose of the vaccine. In Africa, where the Omicron variant was recently discovered, just 7.5% of the continent's population has been fully vaccinated. Most doses of the various vaccines have gone to wealthy countries in Europe and the U.S., which spent hundreds of billions on early orders. Millions of people in these countries are now receiving their third shots, sparking allegations of vaccine hoarding. We're looking into a situation where high-income countries will keep getting regular boosters, while people in low-income countries haven't even had their first dose, said Alexandra Phelan, an adjunct professor of global and public health law and ethics at Georgetown University. What are the consequences? In the global South, the paucity of vaccines means more sicknesses and death, along with economic damage to societies already mired in hunger and poverty. Unvaccinated populations can also become breeding grounds for new coronavirus variants that spread all over the world. Harmful variants can mutate within unvaccinated or immunocompromised populations, such as the large number of untreated HIV-positive people in southern Africa. The Delta variant spread out of control this year in India, where vaccination rates were low at the time. Experts now fear we're entering a vicious cycle where rich countries order boosters to protect against variants developing in poor countries without their own access to vaccines. What causes the unequal distribution? The World Health Organization's COVAX program, backed by United Nations, has largely failed in its promise to deliver 2 billion vaccine doses in 2021 to the countries in dire need of them. There are several reasons for the shortfall. One is that India, where most doses for Africa were supposed to be made, halted vaccine exports when it was hit by a catastrophic wave of COVID in April. Secondly, it has proved difficult to get doses from airports in Africa to syringes and arms. About 40% of vaccines delivered to Africa thus far have not been used, and thousands of doses have expired and been discarded. Thirdly, pharmaceutical companies have delivered just 12% of a promised 994 million doses to COVAX, according to an October report by the People's Vaccine Alliance. COVAX officials have accused the pharma companies of prioritizing rich countries rather than fulfilling their COVAX commitments. We need greater transparency from the industry so it is clear if countries or other buyers are jumping the queue, said COVAX Managing Director Aurelia Nguyen. Would patent waivers help? Some advocates insist drug companies must do more by waiving patents on their vaccines. The U.S. joined Russia and China in May in calling for a temporary ban on intellectual property rights for COVID-19 vaccines, which could help low-income nations boost their own vaccine production. But opponents, including the European Union and drug companies themselves, argue that patent waivers will discourage expensive innovation in research, and it could take years for developing nations to gain the capability to produce their own vaccines, meaning waivers would not make an immediate impact. Executives have also cited global vaccine hesitancy as a reason not to make generic versions of their vaccines, particularly the innovative mRNA vaccines produced by Moderna and Pfizer and BioNTech. People want to be sure that the vaccines they get has the same high quality as we have here in the Western world, said BioNTech Chief Medical Officer Özlem Türeci. Critics dismiss this as an excuse to prioritize profits over public health. Can't surplus vaccines be shipped abroad? Vaccines must be kept in cold storage, especially Pfizer's mRNA shots, and expire quickly once thawed. So it's not possible to load up the unused doses in your local pharmacy and fly them to Botswana. In addition, many developing countries can't find people to inoculate. The same week Omicron was detected, South Africa delayed a delivery of incoming vaccine shipments because officials couldn't use those it already had in stock. That's partly because of vaccine hesitancy, and partly because the world is currently facing a shortfall of 1 billion to 2 billion syringes. Can global vaccine production be boosted? Yes, but it will require time, money, and patience, all things that are in short supply. At least 12 COVID vaccine production facilities are either set up or in the pipeline in six African countries, some of which will fill and finish imported vaccine substance to produce hundreds of millions of doses of Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, China's Sinovac, and Russia's Sputnik V by the end of 2022. BioNTech has announced it will build manufacturing hubs in Rwanda and Senegal, but the continent remains years away from manufacturing enough of its own vaccine to inoculate most of its population. "This is too little too late," said independent public health consultant Rohit Malpani of the BioNTech announcement. "Nothing should have stopped BioNTech from doing this a year ago." And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Starting with, "Our own democracy is in peril. America needs a mass movement to save democracy," said Zach Bocamp. President Biden hosted a virtual summit of democratic nations last week, but the U.S. is no longer a democratic model for the world. Instead, we're sleepwalking toward a disaster in which the Republican minority rigs the political system in its favor, rendering majority rule effectively obsolete. The year began with an attack on the Capitol designed to thwart the transition of power. Since then, Republicans have doubled down on the lie that Trump won the election and are working to make it easier to invalidate votes in urban areas in 2024. They're even organizing at the precinct level to gain control of vote counting. Neither Democrats nor the general public are doing much of anything to stop them. This crisis resembles a sped-up version of the politics of climate change. People know it's happening, but the threat feels too remote and abstract to summon the sense of urgency needed to avert catastrophe. Pro-democracy Americans need to mount a movement as large and passionate as Black Lives Matter, with millions demonstrating in the streets. But it's just not happening. Is this what it looks like when a democracy dies and nobody cares? When teachers fight over $1 bills. It was portrayed as a feel-good story, said Christopher Ingraham. But when teachers have to fight over a pile of $1 bills to pay for school supplies, it's actually proof of staggering social failure. A Sioux Falls, South Dakota mortgage lender last week sponsored a charity event called Dash for Cash, in which $5,000 in singles was dumped on an ice hockey rink, and 10 public school teachers scrambled to stuff the money into their clothing while a crowd hooted. It was a degrading, humiliating, Hunger Games-style debacle that said volumes about our society's values. South Dakota's teacher salaries and per-pupil spending are among the lowest in the nation, half the rate of some larger states. Contrary to claims that more funding for schools doesn't matter, recent research found a strong connection between per-pupil spending and what those students are paid after they graduate. In many states, decades of underfunding of public services means that teachers use their own meager salaries to buy simple supplies. Diabetics have to beg for insulin, and childhood cancer patients have to raise money for their treatment. Requiring teachers, kids, and the chronically sick to rely on charity isn't heartwarming. It's heartless. This column comes from Finland. Don't let minors take the wheel. A child has no business operating a multi-ton death machine, said Pasi Antaronen. So why is the Finnish government planning to lower the legal driving age from 18 to 17? Under current law, 17-year-olds need to apply for a special dispensation to get a driver's license, and it is granted only to young people with demonstrated need. If they have to drive a car for work, for example, or live in an extremely remote area. Last year alone, those younger drivers caused accidents that killed 10 people. That's 10 too many. Some may argue that a year can't make that much difference. But brain development is intense in the late adolescence, and the decline in impulsiveness year on year is stark. One recent study found that 17-year-olds were almost twice as likely to commit traffic offenses as 18-year-olds. It's not as if Finland is currently behind the times. Only a few European countries allow under-18s to drive, and even Finnish children concede that they aren't ready to get behind the wheel. Polls show that half of 15 to 19-year-olds believe that lowering the driving age will impair road safety. The Finnish government has set a goal of halving road deaths in the next decade. Putting reckless kids in the driver's seat is no way to achieve that. And it's time for the last word, our feature article, this week titled, Battling the Children's Plague. For 200 years, parents watched helplessly as their kids died of diphtheria, said author Perry Class in Smithsonian Magazine. Then treatments and vaccines turned the tide in one of medicine's greatest victories. Even Noah Webster, that master of words, did not have a name for the terrible sickness. In May 1735, he wrote in A Brief History of Epidemic and Pestilential Diseases, in a wet, cold season, appeared at Kingston, an island town in New Hampshire, situated in a low plain, a disease among children, commonly called the throat distemper, of a most malignant kind, and by far the most fatal ever known in this country. Webster noted the symptoms, including general weakness and a swollen neck. The disease moved through the colonies, he wrote, and gradually traveled southward, almost stripping the country of children. It was literally the plague among children. Many families lost 3 and 4 children. Many lost all. And children who survived generally went on to die young, he wrote from his vantage point of more than half a century later. The throat distemper had somehow weakened their bodies. In 1821, a French physician, Pierre Bretonneux, gave the disease a name, diphtherite. He based it on the Greek word diphthera, for leather, a reference to the affliction's signature physical feature, a thick, leathery buildup of dead tissue in a patient's throat, which made breathing and swallowing difficult or impossible, and children with their relatively small airways were particularly vulnerable. Throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, diphtheria challenged doctors with the terrible specter of children choked, smothered, snuffed out. It brought terror to the richest and the poorest, blighting famous families and anonymous ones. Queen Victoria's daughter, Princess Alice, died of diphtheria in 1878 at the age of 35. 5 of Alice's children had also been sick with the disease, along with her husband, the Grand Duke of Hesse-Darmstadt. Their youngest child died. Toward the end of the 19th century, scientists started identifying the bacteria that caused this human misery, giving the pathogen a name and delineating its poisonous weapon. It was diphtheria that led researchers around the world to unite in an unprecedented effort, using laboratory investigations to come up with new treatments for struggling, suffocating victims. In my more than 30 years as a practicing pediatrician, I have never seen a single patient with diphtheria. That's because vaccination efforts in this country have been so successful. In the 1980s, when I was training, there were only a few cases a year in the United States. Since 2000, there have been only 6 reported cases in the U.S. I was inspired to become a doctor partly by Paul de Kruijf's 1926 book, Microbe Hunters, a thrilling, even swashbuckling adventure about the encounters between humans and microbes. Among other things, it describes the French scientist Emile Roux, who had been Louis Pasteur's assistant, and the German scientist Emil von Behring trying to find a way to keep diphtheria from killing children in the 1880s in Paris. The wards of the hospitals for sick children were melancholy with forlorn wailing. There were gurgling coughs foretelling suffocation. On the sad rows of narrow beds were white pillows framing small faces blue with the strangling grip of an unknown hand. In 1883, the Prussian pathologist Edwin Klebs found a bacterium lurking in the leathery tissue, known as pseudomembrane, that can block a patient's airway. Friedrich Loeffler, a German bacteriologist, took this microbe and grew it in the lab to solve the mystery of whether it was indeed the cause of the disease. Loeffler infected guinea pigs, rabbits, horses, and dogs with his lab-grown cultures. The bacteria came to be known as the Klebs-Loeffler bacillus. Then in 1888, Roux and Alexander Yersin, medical doctors at the Institut Pasteur in Paris, took another big step when they showed that a substance secreted by the bacteria was the particular culprit. In the lab, researchers grew the bacteria bathed in a broth, after siphoning off the fluid and filtering it to remove any cells. Roux and Yersin found it contained a potent toxin. The scientists mixed the toxin with an iodine solution, which made it far less deadly. Another step. Behring, working with Shibashiro Kitatsu, a Japanese bacteriologist, discovered that weakened tetanus toxin, given repeatedly to experimental animals, prevented those animals from developing symptoms after they were exposed to tetanus bacteria. The toxin had spurred the animal's immune system to recognize and fend off the invading bacteria. Moreover, when lab workers took blood from those immunized animals and removed the blood cells, the remaining serum contained antibodies to tetanus that, when injected into other animals, provided immunity to those animals too. Behring applied the same principle to diphtheria, creating a serum that could be used to combat the disease in humans. He was recognized for this work in 1901 with the first ever Nobel Prize in Medicine. Antitoxin for diphtheria was bacteriology's first great weapon, a technique for borrowing products made by another immune system, antibodies that would hang around in a patient's blood long enough to battle the infection. To make large quantities of this life-saving therapy, Roux and two colleagues, Louis Martin and Auguste Chaloux, relied on horses, which produce copious amounts of serum. In Paris, they injected horses with weakened diphtheria toxin. They waited for the animals to produce antibodies in response, then bled the animals and collected the serum. From February to July 1894, at the city's large Hospital d'Enfants Malades, or Hospital for Sick Children, Martin Roux and Chaloux administered horse serum containing antitoxin to 448 children suffering from diphtheria. Just 109 of them died, giving a fatality rate of 24.3%. Meanwhile, at the pediatric hospital Armand Trousseau, where the serum was not used, the fatality rate was 60%. For any child sick with diphtheria at the very end of the 19th century, the key question was whether the antitoxin would be available. It came to New York City almost immediately. Herman Biggs, chief inspector of pathology, bacteriology, and disinfection at the New York City Board of Health, learned about the antitoxin during a trip to Europe in 1894, and he cabled a colleague to start making serum. But the therapy was distributed unevenly in the United States when the young son of W.E.B. Du Bois got sick. Du Bois, the historian and activist who had been the first African-American to earn a doctoral degree at Harvard, left Philadelphia in 1897 for an academic job in Atlanta. In 1899, his two-year-old son, Burghardt, came down with the diphtheria symptoms. In Dubois' classic 1903 book, The Souls of Black Folk, he wrote about his child's death. And then one night, the little feet pattered wearily to the wee white bed, and the tiny hands trembled, and a warm, flushed face tossed on the pillow, and we knew baby was sick, he wrote. 10 days he lay there, a swift week and 3 endless days, wasting away. The night before Burghardt's death, his father had gone looking for a black doctor, assuming that no white doctor in Atlanta would treat a black child. His son would have had more chance of getting antitoxin in other cities. Dubois' wife, Nina, believed that if the family had stayed in Philadelphia, the child would have survived. Deaths from diphtheria dropped dramatically in places where the antitoxin was most available and the public health infrastructure was most efficient. Cities like Berlin, Paris, New York, Chicago, and Denver. Yet the antitoxin couldn't save everyone. In 1904, former President Grover Cleveland and his wife, Frances, lost their daughter Ruth, a popular figure known affectionately as Baby Ruth, to diphtheria at the age of 12, though she'd received the antitoxin the day before. Perhaps the most famous episode in the battle against diphtheria played out in the territory of Alaska. Curtis Welch, the only physician in Nome, ordered antitoxin for his patients in 1924, but the local harbor froze before a ship could deliver it. Welch arranged for the vials to be carried by train part of the way and to cover the remaining 674 miles, Governor Scott Bone planned a sledding dog relay with 20 teams of dogs and drivers. Significantly, the antitoxin was not the same as the inactivated toxin that would later be included in a vaccine. It did not prompt a child's own immune system to make antibodies, but instead transferred those antibodies made by the horse. A child infected by diphtheria and successfully treated with a horse serum could later contract the infection again. So when von Behring, whose earlier contributions had earned him the noble Von before his last name, developed a vaccine against diphtheria, the work was hailed as a major progress. His vaccine had two components: diphtheria antitoxin, which could battle an active infection, and also an inactivated version of the toxin produced by the bacteria. Within several years of von Behring's achievement, massive pediatric immunization programs were underway in New York City. School nurses were key in these campaigns. Public health authorities provided information in Yiddish, Italian, and just about every other language that would help the vaccine reach immigrant communities. By 1929, the city was also opening diphtheria immunization stations in parks. The groundbreaking campaigns of the 1920s and 30s evolved into a universal program of infant vaccination in the United States. A DTP vaccine, created in the 1940s, combined diphtheria and tetanus toxoids with an inactivated version of the bacteria that caused whooping cough, pertussis. Today's DTaP vaccine still contains inactivated diphtheria and tetanus toxins, and it has been reformulated to include proteins from pertussis, but it includes no actual bacterial cells. The vaccine generates immune reactions that protect against all three diseases. Despite all the progress preventing and treating the disease, diphtheria has not been eradicated and still flares up around the world, according to a recent analysis of cases by Christy Clark, a CDC epidemiologist. She counted almost 9,000 diphtheria cases globally in 2017. Outbreaks tended to occur in places destabilized by population migration and political strife. She cited Bangladesh, Yemen, Nigeria, and Venezuela. Diphtheria emerges, she told me, when anything disrupts routine vaccination. And the disease is still a killer. The mortality rate usually cited is 5 to 10%, but fatalities can be especially high in areas where medical care is not available. A 2011 outbreak in Nigeria had a case fatality rate of almost 43% in children 4 and younger. The antitoxin is still made by injecting horses with weakened diphtheria, though scientists are working to develop newer methods. At a time when so many Americans are distrustful of vaccines, I often think about the talks I used to have with parents in the 1990s. We were still using the old DTP vaccine, which meant children sometimes experienced side effects, especially fevers and sore arms. The discomfort was not nearly as terrifying as the diseases it inoculated against, but parents had no firsthand experience with the diseases themselves, thanks to years of successful vaccinations. My challenge was to help them understand that when they got their babies vaccinated, they were doing their part in a great triumph of human ingenuity and public health. The whole point was to keep those babies safe. In a Canadian Journal article from 1927, a doctor recalled the years before the antitoxin was available, when he'd had to watch a beautiful girl of 5 or 6 years old choke to death. Later, the doctor's own daughter came down with diphtheria, but a decade had passed and now the antitoxin was available. To watch the choking, dreadful membrane melt away and disappear in a few hours with complete restoration to health within a few days, he wrote, was one of the most dramatic and thrilling experiences of my professional career. As science and medicine move forward, vaccines and treatments allow parents and physicians to care for children without dreading some of the most terrifying infections of the past. Remembering these success stories can help us maintain a feeling of awe, gratitude, and a willingness to do our part. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in Smithsonian Magazine. On the Health and Science page, we have Walking with Ancient Humans. A set of fossilized footprints found in northern Tanzania in 1978 is widely viewed as the earliest uncontested evidence of ancient humans walking upright. The prints at Letoli have been dated to 3.6 million years ago and are thought to have been made by the same species that left behind the famous Lucy skeleton. But Lucy's relatives might not have been the only humans strolling around Laetoli. A new study suggests that another set of prints found at the site in 1976, which were long thought to have been left by a bear, were in fact made by a different early human species. The researchers began to doubt the bear theory after analyzing footprint data from humans, chimpanzees, and bears. So they went back to Laetoli and dug down to the prints. Their analysis confirmed that these couldn't have been made by a bear or a chimpanzee, and that they had a very different characteristic to the A. afarensis footprints. That left another hominin species as the only plausible possibility. There were at least two hominins walking in different ways on different shaped feet at this time, co-author Jeremy Da Silva from Dartmouth College tells CNN.com. This shows that the acquisition of human-like walking was less linear than many imagine. And we'll finish out on the Talking Points page. Here's an article titled, Long COVID, an Epidemic of Lasting Disability. Before he got COVID in March 2020, John Buccioletto was an emergency medicine doctor at an urgent care clinic in Manhattan. Today, he's engulfed in a healthcare crisis, said Christopher Rowland in the Washington Post. Suffering pervasive symptoms such as brain bleeding and brain fog, he repeats himself and seems easily confused and is unable to work. COVID-19 took my career away, he said. He's one of an estimated 750,000 to 1.3 million COVID long haulers in the U.S. suffering unbearable fatigue and other maladies that have left them unable to resume their former lives. They're abandoning careers, falling behind on mortgages, and battling acute depression and anxiety. For long haulers, a bout with COVID has altered their lives, said Yale cardiologist Harlan Krumholtz. Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, long COVID remains little understood, said Pam Bellick in the New York Times. Facing devastated patients desperate for answers, a growing number of post-COVID clinics are experimenting with treatments, but have little data on outcomes. The afflicted, who include children, face a bewildering array of maladies, including dizziness, crippling fatigue, labored breathing, gastrointestinal problems, memory loss, and confusion. Samantha Lewis, 34, of Aurora, Illinois, used to juggle raising an autistic daughter in a demanding, detail-oriented job, running group homes for disabled adults. Now she suffers nausea and diarrhea, walks with a cane, and has index cards pasted by the bathroom sink reminding her how to brush her teeth. Intensive rehab has brought improvement, but there's certainly a possibility that she may not become fully recovered, said her doctor. Brown University School of Public Health has launched a study to assess the broad impact of long COVID on our society. Dean Ashish Jha estimates we'll see tens of millions of Americans with long-term disabilities. It's a challenge the nation is ill-equipped to handle, said Adriana Belmont in finance.yahoo.com. Like many long haulers, Rachel Bean, a 34-year-old Minneapolis resident, had to quit her job because there are days when she is so weak she can barely speak. But she hasn't qualified for disability benefits because no medical test will prove she's sick. So she is living on borrowed money and funds from cashing out a 401k retirement account. Long COVID, Bean said, is a mass disabling event. Hispanics in play for the GOP? Democrats have a major problem with Hispanic voters, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. In the 2020 election, Donald Trump greatly improved his 2016 performance with Hispanics, winning 32% of their vote. And it's now clear those results weren't an anomaly. A new Wall Street Journal poll found if Joe Biden were to run against Trump today, Biden would get 44% of the Hispanic vote, and Trump would get 43%. When Hispanic voters were asked whether they would back Republicans or Democrats for Congress, it was a tie at 37%. It's just one poll, but this and other data show nothing remotely close to the 40-point advantage Democrats enjoyed among Hispanics in 2018. The explanation is rather obvious in Matthew Iglesias and slowboring.com. Progressives seem very uninterested in paying attention to the actual views of Americans of Latin ancestry. Many critics cite the progressive use of gender-neutral Latinx, which only 3% of Latinos and Latinas actually use. But that's a symptom, not a cause, of the disconnect. Recent polling shows that Hispanics have a relatively high level of confidence in the U.S. criminal justice system and don't share the progressive view of cops as racist and abusive. After jumping through hoops to gain citizenship or legal status, most Hispanics show little enthusiasm for Central American asylum seekers. Perhaps most important of all, Hispanics are climbing the economic ladder and perceive the U.S. as a land of opportunity. So, like other working-class voters, they're turned off by identity politics and focused on kitchen table issues. Many Hispanics see Trump as a commanding provider who generated wealth and prosperity for himself and others, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. After a growing share of Hispanics are embracing evangelical Christianity, which is closely allied with the GOP and Trump. So much for Democrats' demographic triumphalism, said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com. Conservatives have for years reacted with pessimism bordering on despair to the conventional wisdom that America's growing diversity automatically benefits the left. Some responded by embracing ugly great replacement conspiracy theories. Now that Republicans are breaking through to something much closer to parity with Democrats among Hispanics, they should resist extremist paranoia about demographic change and start recruiting. And we have time for a few short notes. starting with at least 12 major cities in the U.S. have hit annual records for homicides in 2021, five of them topping marks that were set the year before. "It's just crazy and it needs to stop," said Jim Kenney, the mayor of Philadelphia. Guns are involved in the vast majority of the killings, and experts also pointed to a 45% jump in police retirements in 2020 and 21, and a 24% drop in arrests in 2020. One in 100 Americans 65 or over has died from the coronavirus. 75% of COVID fatalities in America, about 600,000 deaths, have struck people 65 or older. About 80% of Democrats have already chosen to vaccinate their children ages 12 to 17, compared with just 25% of Republicans. Only 5% of Republican parents and 24% of Democrats have brought their 5 to 11-year-olds to be vaccinated since regulators approved the Pfizer shot for younger children in October. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from author John Irving, who says, "It is hard work and great art to make life not so serious." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.